Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
From CBS News headquarters in New York, here is Dan Rather.
It was just over 90 minutes beyond President Bush's deadline for Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq that U.S. warships and planes, there were F-117 stealth bombers involved, launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom. The attack came in waves, cruise missiles followed by the F-117 stealth bombers with so-called bunker-busting bombs. Their target, a bunker believed to be sheltering what are called top leaders of the Iraqi regime.
It was March 19, 2003, and CBS anchor Dan Rather was reporting on the attack ordered that day by President George W. Bush on a compound known as Dora Farms, where the CIA had gotten intelligence that Saddam Hussein was visiting along with his family. If U.S. weapons could knock Saddam out there, it was thought maybe the long-planned invasion of the country could be averted. Bush's war cabinet assembled at the White House to discuss the options and then greenlight a plan to send F-117 jets to bomb the compound. As it turns out, that intelligence, like so much else about Iraq, was wrong, and Saddam had already left by the time the bombers had struck. But it's worth recalling the intense debate and planning that took place inside the White House that day in light of the extraordinary disclosure this week that the plans for another military operation, this time against the Houthis in Yemen, were discussed in detail among top Trump officials on their personal cell phones with, unbeknownst to them, a journalist listening in to the whole thing. What would have been the reaction back in 2003 if a journalist was eavesdropping on the planning for the Dora Farms attack? And what would have been the consequences for whoever it was that invited the journalist to listen in? We'll talk to somebody who may be the best person in the world to answer those questions. Luis Rueda, the veteran CIA officer who, as head of the agency's Iraq Operations Group, briefed Bush's war cabinet that day. He's our guest to talk about that and much else on this episode of Spy Talk. Luis Rueda, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I've really wanted to talk to you for quite some time. Many years ago, I co-authored a book, Hubris, about the war in Iraq, in which you were a character, but I couldn't talk to you then because you were then in, inside the CIA. You're now out, retired. You can speak your piece. So lots that I want to talk to you about your career, about Iraq, and much else. But before we do, I got to start out with this amazing story this week, Signalgate. Top Trump officials talking on their personal cell phones about imminent plans to attack Yemen. And it made me think of the time back in 2003, March 19th, when you and other Bush war cabinet members were at the White House briefing the president on imminent plans to attack Dora Farms, where you believed Saddam Hussein was at. And I just wondered if you had learned then that a journalist was listening in on the conversation you were having about these sensitive war plans to attack Dora Farms, what the reaction would have been and what the consequences would have been for anybody who let that journalist in on the conversation.
Good question. Clearly the reaction would have been a lot of emotion, a lot of anger, frustration. Let me start with a story, if I can. This idea of, you know, what would have happened if somebody had revealed this kind of information. I think the first thing that comes into mind, if this had been an agency officer who had done something like this, the first thing that comes to mind would have been their suitability to continue employment. It is not just a major gaffe, but an indication of terrible judgment on an individual. If somebody had revealed this information on Iraq while we were doing this, the first thing that would have happened is they would have been taken out of the Iraq operations. They would have been sidelined and moved on. There would have been an accountability board. And the story I want to tell you is I sat in on an accountability board where an officer who had a briefcase that he should have kept on his person at all times decided to lock it in the trunk of his car while he went to a meeting in a local pub. Obviously, the briefcase was stolen. It wasn't a major loss of intelligence or capabilities, but that individual was recalled home. We had an accountability board to determine whether they should continue to be employed, whether they were suitable for this job, whether they had the judgment to do this job. And at the end, they kept him on, but he lost his promotion, was pulled out of the assignment, and lost the follow-on assignment, and had to sit in Washington for 3 years. That's a big kick in an individual's career. In this case, while the information that was leaked was classified, there's no doubt about it, and all this back and forth and bullshit, whether it was or not, is garbage. It was, but I think there are a few bigger issues involving this. And the first one is, as was the case that I just described, is judgment. You have the top tier of U.S. national security and intelligence policy committing one of the most basic fundamental mistakes that a new hire would make, and that's operational security. These people should know better. They run our intelligence organizations. And if they can't figure out that getting on a commercial communications app on their private phones is a security violation, how the hell are they going to be able to deal with much more complex, much more serious issues? This is a mistake that new hires make, not experienced senior personnel.
Just further adding to that, something that hasn't gotten much attention so far in all this, but last October, in the closing weeks of the presidential campaign, U.S. national security officials confirmed that hackers associated with the Chinese, with the PRC, had targeted the cell phones of Trump, of Vance, of people associated with Harris's campaign. And the New York Times, reporting that at the time, said the type of information on phones used by a presidential candidate and his running mate could be a gold mine for an intelligence agency, who they called and texted, how often they communicated with certain people, how long they talked to those people, could be highly valuable to an adversary like China. Now, leave aside the invitation to the journalists to listen in, they were all using their personal cell phones mm-hmm. on Signal. What is that, a breach in and of itself, or shouldn't it have been?
It is a breach. Look, we have even allies. We have a lot of countries that are interested in intercepting communications of senior officials. Not just the Russians and the Chinese. The Israelis will do it. The French will do it. It is a gold mine. It is, you know, what are they saying? What's the policy? If you're on your personal phone, your judgment is pretty much impaired, and you're going to say things you shouldn't say. So it is an intelligence gold mine. I would have to assume that all their personal phones are compromised in one way or the other. And you've got the National Security Advisor using his personal phone in Moscow. The assumption.
Well, he wasn't in my. No, it was Witkoff who was
Witkoff,
in Moscow.
Okay.
And to be fair, he does say he was using his government phone in while he was in Moscow.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, I mean, right.
The other guys were using their personal phones.
Yes. And yeah. It is the counterintelligence environment, the electronic attacks on these individual cell phones is immense. That's why the U.S. government doesn't want them to use their cell phones.
Right.
They're susceptible. And if they hacked into them during the campaign, unless they swapped them out, I guarantee you those phones are compromised.
So overall, when you look at this, I mean, what what should happen and how does it get fixed?
Well, what should happen is clearly somebody should resign. If we had capable, honorable leaders, and this is a leadership issue, they'd say, look, you're right. We're wrong. We made a huge mistake. I'm taking a hit for the team and I step down.
Yeah.
I think the bigger problem is the fact that knowingly, they were all issued waivers to use the Signal app. I guarantee you, this is the tip of the iceberg. This is not just an isolated incident. I would bet you money that this is widespread throughout the administration, that people are discussing policy and whether classified or not classified, sensitive information on the Signal app, on their private phones, and all that is getting hoovered up by foreign intelligence organizations. And I doubt that this one classified discussion on the Houthi attack was the only one they did. This is one of probably several they've done.
And when you is Signal itself vulnerable?
Yes. Cell phones, you know, cell phones for us, for the yeah. intelligence profession, are a curse. You know, you're tracked with them. The signals are easily intercepted. Commercially available encryption is good, but not great.
Yeah.
You know, if you put enough resources, and there are nations who can do this, you can crack through that system. And we don't know what the other side's capability is. We don't know what they've developed. So we can look and say, well, it's hard for us to do it. We don't know what the Chinese have been able to do. We don't know what the Russians have done. And the Russians are very good at technical operations.
Right.
So all that is
right. And I mean, look, even if, you know, the encryption was not intercepted by a foreign adversary, if the end user cell phones have been targeted and have been penetrated, then it doesn't matter that the material might be encrypted because you could still read it on
right.
that person's cell phone.
You're, right? you're getting you it know. From you know the yeah. endpoints as opposed to into the middle.
Yeah.
Once
yeah.
your phone is hacked into, that's it. Doesn't matter. It's like a keystroke monitor. They can yeah. see you typing as you type.
Yeah. So I count this as another Intel fiasco to the many in the long litany yeah. of Intel fiascos over the years, some of which you have been a party to, I do have to say, or certainly an eyewitness to. So I did want to talk to you because you had an illustrious career in the CIA, and I'd like to explore it a little. We'll get to Iraq, which is, you know, probably the big one. But tell us a little about your background and how you got into the CIA to begin.
I was born in Cuba. We lost everything as a result of the revolution, the communist revolution. My father and uncles were involved in what at the time passed for a Cuban underground activity, all of which was wrapped up immediately before and during the Bay of Pigs. Long story, but you know, we eventually got asylum through a long process. We got asylum in the U.S.
So did your father participate in the Bay of Pigs?
No, my father was on island. And he was mm-hmm. part of I guess the best word is fundraising and intelligence collection operation for the Cuban underground to sort of support what was coming. What happened was the Cubans knew about it. They started arresting everybody in the town we lived in. My father and uncle could not get back inside, so they spent the night in a cemetery and then got asylum in the Brazilian embassy. Eventually, they were allowed through an agreement between the Brazilians and the Cubans to leave, landed in Mexico. And lo and behold, at the bottom of the stairs from the aircraft was a U.S. consular official meeting all the Cubans saying, would you like to come to the U.S.? So I grew up in a very, very anti-communist household. For us, it was, you know, it's something I guess people don't understand nowadays since we won the Cold War. But I grew up with the understanding that if we lost the Cold War, we would literally be lined up against the wall and shot because we were on a list of counter-revolutionaries. So it was a no-brainer that I owed something to the U.S. I had to give back. When we arrived in the United States, all the men in the family volunteered for the military. It was a very serious thing for us. Plus, I've got attention issues. I get bored easily. And here's a job that they said, look, you know, we're going to pick you up every 2 or 3 years, move you to someplace different, and get to do all this neat stuff, and we'll pay you for it too. And I thought, this is pretty exciting. So I joined.
What year?
Shit. I wish it had 1980.
1980.
Yeah.
81.
81.
So 81. That's the William Casey era,
yes.
Right?
I mean, yes.
He's just taken over.
I was a Casey
under
baby.
Under Ronald Reagan.
Reagan baby. Yeah. When the agency, I came on board when the agency was rebuilding after Stansfield Turner years, when he had sort of gutted the DO, the director of operations, and got rid of a lot of case officers. So when I came in, there was a huge gap between the brand new people and the senior people, because all the middle ranks were thinned out.
Right.
So that's when I joined. It was an interesting time. I mean, we were running covert action programs in Central America, Afghanistan, Africa. The U.S. was, I guess, on an upswing battling communism. I remember I had finished all my training and I was heading out overseas, and Reagan came in to the building to dedicate the new annex, the addition to the headquarters building.
Right.
And he was going to do that. And he had a special meeting inside the lobby of the agency where they have the stars on the wall and all this kind of stuff, just for the clandestine service, because there were journalists and photographers at the ground laying ceremony. So he wanted to address everybody. And he gave this speech. You know, he started out with his usual jokes and stuff. And I still remember it to this day. He said, you are the tripwire of democracy over which the forces of totalitarianism must stumble. I got to tell you, there wasn't a dry eye in that lobby. You had guys who'd been there for 30 years, had seen everything, and just tears are coming down their face. And it wow. was, I mean, that carried me through the next 3 or 4 years yeah. of bullshit.
So did you participate in the Central American operations, running drugs to the Contras?
No, we didn't run drugs to the Contras.
Not drugs. I'm sorry. Yeah. Take that back. Running guns to the Contras. I mean,
I wanted to go to what's then SC, Soviet and East European Division.
Okay.
And I'll tell you again the story. When you're down at the farm doing training, they have a thing they call division night. Every Sunday night, the different area divisions, Africa, Middle East, you know, Soviet Union, would come down, a different one each Sunday, and give you a presentation on why you should come and work for them. Partly it was to get the students back at a reasonable time on Sunday so they get some rest before the week started. And mm-hmm. partly to make a rational decision what you want to go. And the division chief for SE, Soviet Eastern Europe, got up on the stage and gave the shortest but best presentation I've ever heard. And he stood there and said, the CIA exists because the Soviet Union could wipe us out in 24 minutes. Any questions? And that was it. You're like, that's the reason. That's why we're here. Unfortunately for me, We had a huge ass war going on in Central America, and Latin America division had a draft on. They got the lion's share of people, and they picked me because I spoke Spanish. They can get me overseas relatively quickly and all this stuff. So yes, I wound up, my first interim assignment was working propaganda media operations for Central America. Then I went overseas. And for the first couple of tours I did, I did a lot of stuff, because I was what they call an operations generalist. I chased Russians, Chinese, the local target. I did Central America stuff, media things, and all that sort of thing.
When you say propaganda, tell us a little bit about what that entailed at the time.
Oh, there's a lot of terms. It's media operations. Yeah. It's information warfare, misinformation, disinformation. At the agency, we sort of classified it as three types: white, gray, and black. White propaganda it's the truth. We just amplify it. The sun comes up tomorrow. We make sure every newspaper carries the term "the sun comes up tomorrow." Gray is the sun comes up tomorrow, thanks to America. And it's sort of the truth with a little twist in it. And black propaganda is the sun's not coming up tomorrow because the communists are in charge. And it's outright BS, but you're trying to influence the masses. And everybody understands the concept that you do it depending on what the target audience is you want to get to, because different messages go to different targets. How you want to convey it. Does a country watch television? Do they do radio? And it's changed a lot now because we've got social media. So, social media is probably now the biggest part of this, because everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody's on Twitter slash X and this kind of stuff. But it is an effort to influence foreign groups, whether it's the people, policymakers, the military, whatever.
I thought there were restrictions on the extent to which you could lie, which I think black falls in that category, if it accessible to the American public.
We are not allowed to get any of this stuff in the U.S. press and the U.S. media.
But in a global media world, prevent lies you're telling to foreign foreign peoples from finding its way back to the United States?
Well, it look, when you to do any of these kinds of operations, you need what we call a presidential finding, and that means the president says, "I find that these people are a problem. Everybody's got to do this. Here's what the CIA's got to do." When we write the finding, or the National Security writes the finding, they ensure there is wiggle room. As an example, we cannot use U.S. journalists or stringers that work for the U.S. press. We cannot knowingly or willingly allow propaganda to get into the U.S. press. But we understand that that could happen outside of our control, and we don't intend to. What may happen at times is the director, if we find out that, say, a major newspaper or news channel is going to go out with a story that we invented and put out, you'll get a situation where the director will call the owner of the paper or the editor or the head of the news and say, "Look, just between you and I, don't put that out. That's ours." But there's a limitation to what we can do, because if a journalist gets it, puts it out, and we don't know about it, it's out.
Any examples of the black arts you can share?
No. when you retire, there's the two things you cannot discuss are sources and methods.
Right.
So discussing actual
operations. So black arts propaganda, i.e. lying, is one of those areas that
It's any of those areas. You can't go out and say, "Hey, we put this article in this newspaper."
Right.
You just can't, whether it's true, not, whatever, you're revealing methods and how we get stuff. But at the end of the day, the black propaganda is one of those, use it when you think it'll work, but it's not the preferred method, because eventually most of the target audience is fairly sophisticated, and it's going to be very hard for you, at least in my day, right. Because what you're trying to do is get the government officials, policymakers, wealthy people who run the country to look at things in a certain way. If you come out with outright lies, they're going to see through that. So it becomes less effective. You know, you'll want to do something like that. And I guess, you know, I'll make stuff up so I don't reveal anything. But if it's 1944, you know, you want the Nazis to kill each other. So right. You're going to put out a piece that says Goebbels is trying to assassinate Goering. And so Goering, oh, my God, he's going to kill me. So he tries to kill him. And I'm, you know, this is an exaggerated, over the top example. But that's
although
one of the
I think there was
do.
Plenty of that from yeah. what I recall from my World War II history. So moving along. So you start out doing Central American stuff. And do you stay there or do you migrate elsewhere in the.
What happens is in those days, it's changed now. The director of operations was run along medieval feudalism. And when you joined a division, they owned you. You could not leave, in my case, Latin America, without their permission. And they never gave that permission because they don't lose bodies. So I spent 12 years bopping around in Central America, Latin America. Yeah. And when as Central America started to wind down, counter-narcotics started to wind up. So right. I spent the next three tours doing counter-narcotics.
Colombia, where the Medellin cartel, Pablo
Mexico,
Escobar,
Bolivia, those kind of places. It was, I got to tell you, it's the most frustrating work I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
you're banging your head against the wall. You have minimal impact no matter what you do. Bolivia is a great example. There were at one point five major drug cartels in Bolivia. They were all dismantled, every single one. You'd figure that would have an impact. Now, we just took the middlemen out and the Mexicans showed up and were buying the stuff directly and shipping it back to Mexico. Yeah. No marginal, no visible impact on the drug trade. And it's one of those things, even if you did have an impact and you reduced the flow of, say, of cocaine, the only thing that means is the price goes up. So they're still making money, if not more. I went to a conference and they had DEA brought out one of the drug cartel finance guys who they had flipped and was now in the witness protection program. And he addressed the people there. They were, you know, agency, DEA, State Department, DOD. And he said the most depressing thing that I heard about the drug trade. He said, before, for us to lose money, for you to impact our gains, our profits, you have to intercept 95% of the cocaine that goes into the U.S. We were intercepting 5% on a good day.
Yeah.
And he looked and said, what you guys are doing, that's the cost of doing business. We don't care. And the problem had been we weren't addressing the real problem.
Which was the demand side.
Yep. Consumption in the U.S.
Right.
The movement of weapons from the U.S. The laundering of money through U.S. banks. We weren't addressing any of that because we don't want to accept the fact that, hey, it's our problem, our fault.
Yeah.
And you had traffic. I mean, these guys, they were facing either a life of $40, $60, $70 a month, or $20,000 or $30,000 a month. Guess what they were choosing? The rank and file guys. So it was extremely frustrating.
Trump has declared the Mexican cartels foreign terrorist organizations. Yeah. Does this matter? Is this going to make a difference?
Yes and no. It makes a difference in terms of what the U.S. government is allowed to do. I mean, you know, narcotics trafficking is not terrorism. It is a criminal enterprise. It is capitalism on steroids with a lot of violence. But they're not, you know, terrorism by implication. You want to have an impact politically on your target. They don't care. But what it is going to do is allow the administration to do certain things that they might not be able to do. Now, when the U.S. fought the war on drugs, there was almost nothing that we couldn't do. So the only thing they're going to be able to ramp up here is the use of drones, airstrikes, and SOCOM teams inside Mexico, if that's what he wants to do. But is it going to impact the trade? No. What are you going to do? The labs you're going to hit, it's not Pfizer. They're made to be able to picked up and moved. You take it out, they'll rebuild it. They'll start building them inside cities, in apartment buildings. It doesn't take a lot. So what are you going to do? You're going to drop a 2,000-pound JDAM on an apartment building in Mexico City? They'll move them south. They'll move them further. You hit Mexico. Guess what's going to happen if you start having an impact on the Mexican drug trade? Colombians are going to come back, and the Bolivians will come back, and the Peruvians. There's always somebody to fill the void.
Yeah.
Unless you hit the side.
Yeah. And I got to say, as somebody who covered all that back in the day, there were many people saying the same thing at the time, but it was not a message that people wanted to hear. No. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Luis about his most famous excursion at the CIA as director of the Iraq Operations Group in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And we're back with Luis Rueda of the formerly for many years of the CIA. So we talked about your career, how you got into the CIA, your days in Latin America, but you are best known as the guy who got tapped to run the Iraq Operations Group in the run-up to the war in Iraq. How did that come about?
I volunteered. For a variety of reasons, I was going to be stuck in Washington. I got to tell you, for most case officers, being in Washington is not a fun thing. There are few jobs in Washington that are interesting. I was serving as executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA.
Which is John McLaughlin at the time, correct?
Yeah, which in itself is a fabulous job. You get to see a lot of stuff and you learn a lot. And, you know, working for the team of John McLaughlin, George Tenet was a godsend. I mean, whatever you feel about them, they're excellent leaders. And so I noticed that the new administration, the Bush administration, was devoting a lot of attention to Iraq. And there were rumblings that they were going to do something about Iraq. So I asked for that assignment because I thought it would be interesting. It would be challenging, something that, you know, would keep me busy. And so they gave me the job.
And the plan was to sort of set the stage for an invasion by drawing up a plan to destabilize the Saddam regime, sabotage, and other covert actions, including lethality, by the CIA against this regime.
There's a nuance. It wasn't, we weren't there to set the stage for an invasion.
You were there to overthrow regime.
No. We had been asked to do that. And early on in my tenure, they'd ask, you know, can you do a covert action program to overthrow the regime? And we responded honestly, said, no, we can't. That's a fool's errand. There is no opposition inside Iraq. He's killed them or driven them into exile. There's nobody willing to stick their head up against Saddam. I mean, you know, if he catches, and he did this in the 90s, when he's got the first whiff of an agency program to create some kind of internal insurrection, he slaughtered people. And it's not just that he gets you and tortures you and executes you. He will get your family and torture and execute them, and he will grind your village into dust. And in turn, what do we have to offer? Not a whole lot. That's you know, it's a big conversation. We said, no, we can't overthrow him. So the Bush administration made the decision then it is going to require an invasion. And the agency's covert action program was designed to support that invasion.
Right. Well, that isn't that what I said? You're setting the stage for the invasion.
Yeah,
right.
We weren't going to. Our job to create a reason for the invasion. It was our job to support whatever the military was going to do.
And what was Operation Anabasis?
It was a covert action program. It was a program first and foremost designed to collect intelligence that the military needed for operations. It was a program designed to create the impression that we were going to do the same thing we had done back in the 90s, and that we were going to go reach out, create an internal opposition, that we were going to overthrow him, launch a coup, to sort of distract him from the buildup that was happening in Kuwait and in Jordan. It's sort of a misdirection kind of thing.
Did you have dealings during that time with Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress?
CIA did not know. Chalabi was handled by the Defense Department. He dealt with the vice president's office and the Pentagon.
What was the view of the CIA of Chalabi and his organization?
Oh, it wasn't just the CIA. It was the CIA, the State Department, and the DOD people who were working with him. He was a con man. He was corrupt. He was ineffective, had no support inside Iraq. But he had the ear of key senior administration officials. I even had, members of the Pentagon come to me and say, boy, we really don't like this, but we have been ordered to work with him and support him. So we thought the guy was on the take. I mean, he's a con man. He was taking everybody's money. He had no real reach inside Iraq. His information was BS. I'll give you
an example, please do.
We got a message that the INC, Iraqi National Congress, Chalabi's group, had an Iraqi nuclear physicist who had left the country and wanted to tell us about the WMD program. Our initial reaction was, no, we don't want to waste time because this is bullshit. Chalabi is bullshit. But the powers that be out of the White House said, you will go. So we made a multifaceted team, agency people, analysts, including an agency nuclear physicist, DOD people, so that they couldn't say it's, you know, the agency was biased. And they went and debriefed the guy in a hotel room. I won't mention the country or any of that sort of stuff. But they debriefing the guy. And he was clearly nervous because every 10 minutes he'd get up and go to the bathroom. And about the fourth time he did that, the CIA analyst said, this is fishy. And the bathroom door is one of those doors with the glass transom on top that you open. So he stood in a chair and looked inside. The guy had written down his arm all kinds of nuclear stuff. And that's what he was telling us. He'd go in there, read it, and come back and regurgitate it. And the analyst said, this guy's not a nuclear physicist. He doesn't know shit about nuclear physics.
Yeah.
And so clearly, you know, the INC was trying to feed the belief that the reason to go to war.
I mean, but some of those same characters, I don't know if this one in particular, were being fed to the news media
Yes.
Most prominently, the New York Times, which was writing front page stories mm-hmm. about what these people said.
Yes. I can't remember the guy, but there was an Iraqi who we debriefed that he had worked as a guard in, what is it? Was it Salman Pak, where they had they were training terrorists mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And we debriefed him. And it's like, no, we really, there's nothing there. We sent him on his way. INC got a hold of him, held a press conference in the U.S. And a guy talked about all these, you know, training Al-Qaeda and doing this kind of shit. And we eventually grabbed him and pulled him aside. I said, what is that? Why did you tell us? He goes, they're paying me and they're going to get me paroled into the U.S. So I say what they want me to say. So the INC was feeding the press. They were feeding the government. They were feeding everybody what they wanted everybody to believe.
Okay. But these false, phony stories the mm-hmm. INC is feeding about Iraqi WMD, I mean, that becomes the public explanation and justification that the Bush administration is using for the invasion. Mm-hmm. If you thought that much of this was bullshit, what was your attitude towards the invasion you were being asked to support?
Well, you also have to step back and say it's not the CIA, in addition to DOD, State Department, NSA, the Brits, the Germans, we all did believe he had WMD. The sources, some of these sources that were coming out, we knew were bullshit, and we were saying they were. But there was a belief held that he did have WMD. The analysts did put out publications saying, here's what we think he has and what he's hiding. So it wasn't, and you know, frankly, I'm not an analyst or a nuclear weapons expert, but they were saying he did. So I believe it, I accept it. But 70% of the intelligence coming out of counterproliferation division that did the collecting on that said he had WMD. So there was a belief throughout the system. It wasn't that we were looking and saying, no, he doesn't have it, but they're going to invade. We did believe it.
But you didn't believe that he was in a position to use it.
Yeah.
No. Against the United States.
No. And right. that was made very clear. They said, look, even if he has WMD, at most he's got WMD to hold back the Iranians in case they want their revenge for the Iran-Iraq war. Right. But he is not in a position to do anything to the U.S., and it is not likely that he will. And the CIA assessment was this guy poses no direct threat to the U.S. And poses almost no regional threat. The embargo on him, the no-fly zones, have reduced the military to the point that it really doesn't present a threat, given the U.S. military presence in the region.
But that's not what folks in the White House were saying.
No, it's not what they wanted to hear. We went through one fiasco of an investigation where I don't know where they got it, but the White House came up with information that a member of the Iraqi mission to the UN had bought a bunch of, what do you call this? They're not drones, those remote control planes, you know, that kids have and adults have.
Right.
And they were speculating, are they going to put those planes on a container ship and load them up with chemical weapons and fly them off and attack New York or Washington?
Yeah.
And we looked at them and go, no, really? No, that's not going to happen. That's not possible. Yada, yada. But they wanted to go to war with Iraq.
It wasn't just WMD. They also strongly implied, suggested, and finally said that there was ties between Saddam and Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
And Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
And in particular, when in Powell's speech to the Security Council, he says, now it can be told there was a Al-Qaeda detainee, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, who has fessed up and told us this whole story. We didn't learn until much later that, in fact, he was tortured by the Egyptians and then recanted the story. But this was cited by the CIA, and George Tenet provided this to Powell, that this was evidence of the Al-Qaeda-Iraq connection.
I cannot address the Powell speech because I was not involved in the information or the writing. I can tell you that we had multiple meetings with the vice president, his national security people,
Scooter Libby.
Yeah, members of DOD.
Right.
And the agency was very clear. There is no connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. The only information we had were two meetings between the head of Iraqi intelligence and Al-Qaeda, and I think it was al-Libi, and they had two meetings, and we said they were basically like dogs sniffing each other, looking at each other and saying, can we do business? And they both walked away saying, no,
yeah,
we can't.
Yeah. No, I remember that. But the al-Libi thing, I think, came later. And it is in the Powell speech. He doesn't use the name of the guy.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. Yeah. But
yeah.
I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know how it got there. I was not privy to the to the speech and how it was written and the information that got in. I know that we had Doug Feith had set up a unit at DOD,
yeah,
that was a parallel unit to get the intelligence on connections to Al-Qaeda. And he came and briefed us. And we said, no, it's your strongest case. And he showed us the intel. This is CIA intel. Said, yeah. And we said, this guy's a fabricator. We have no information, nothing conclusive, not even it points to the possibility of connections between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
So as you're preparing, you're heading the Iraqi operations group, you're getting ready for this massive invasion, you're doing everything you can to destabilize the Saddam regime, and you're listening to all this rhetoric coming out of the White House and the Pentagon saying things that go beyond what you know the intelligence to be. What are you thinking?
Honestly, I am thinking we're going to fuck this up four ways from Sunday. You had, and this is what's very scary. You had policymakers that had an end game and wanted the information to support the end game. And we were given information that says, here's the options. Here's what could happen, what might not happen. And none of them were paying attention. The big concern we were having is the day after. What are you going to do the day after? There was no doubt that we were going to win the war. They had a briefing in the sit room. I was there. And they briefed the president, DOD did, on the day after piece. Here's what we're going to do the day after. And the briefing started out with, and I kid you not, copies, slides of old mimeographed 1945 documents on the occupation of Germany. And this is how we're going to do it. And I cannot tell you how many people around that table were sitting there with their mouths open. And it was so bad that Rumsfeld had to stop the presentation and turn to the president and say, we're not ready yet, Mr. President. We'll get back to you.
Huh.
And that's when everybody knew we're fucked. These guys have no plan for the day after, because there was never another briefing about it and there was never another discussion about it.
You have said after the invasion, we made every mistake in the book.
Yes.
Go through the book of mistakes
that were made. the analysts presented the administration with a list of things you should not do the day after we win. Things like, do not disband the army. Do not debathify. I mean, I was in the Oval Office, and the president had asked me, what do we do about the bath party? And I said, well, there's 75,000 bathies in Iraq. But he said, and I said, 70,000 really aren't bathies. It's like the Communist Party. You have to be a member to be a teacher, to be a policeman, to run the oil refinery, to turn the electricity on. These people don't give a shit about bathism. You got about 5,000 hardcore people. Those are the ones you need to weed out. The rest of them, you need them to run the country. And so what do? They fire everybody who's a member of the Ba'ath Party. We suggested take the army, the regular army, not the Republican Guard, and put them on the borders to protect the borders. Use them as a border police. Because if you get rid of them, that's 450,000 unemployed people, plus family and plus people who depend on them, that you're going to turn loose. That's not a good combination. They didn't listen. So they took all those things. We mentioned, and I say we, it was the agency, and mostly was the analysts who were doing this. You need to secure the infrastructure, the water plants, the power plants, the oil production stuff. You need to secure it. They didn't have people to secure it. They didn't care. Because, in my opinion, they were taking what Chalabi was saying at face value. And Chalabi was saying, look, I have all these followings. Everybody, you know, will come up and help, and I'll reconstitute the government, and we'll do all this kind of stuff. He had nothing. And they thought he would be able to carry the day, and he couldn't. So as you know, we're telling them, here's the things that you really have to watch out. And they were very polite about it. It wasn't don't do this, but it was, you need to be careful about this. You need to pay attention to this. And it looked like they just took the list and said, this is exactly what we're going to do. All these things you're telling us to watch out for, we're going to do.
Not to do. And the consequences?
Well, we know what the consequences are. Chaos. Yeah. From the first few days, we were welcomed as liberators. And, you know, we told them, we're going to get this onrush. Everybody is going to love us because we've just removed a horrible creature from off their neck. But we told them they're going to have unrealistic expectations of what we're going to do. And you got to meet some of those expectations. They're going to think, oh, everything's going to be fine and dandy, and we're going to do this, and life's going to be good. You need to be able to produce stuff. And they didn't pay attention to any of that stuff. They figured, oh, it's going to take care of itself. And there's a tendency in the U.S. we don't like nation building. We break the stuff, and then we don't want to be responsible for putting it together. And during a variety of principals committee meetings, it was uttered, especially from the State Department, we're going to need to put things together. We're going to own it. And we even brought some Kurds in. I remember we brought Barham Saleh to the Oval to meet with Bush. And he made a very cogent argument. He said, look, you know, when this is all done, and if you get rid of the police and the military, he says, what are you going to do if there is a domestic dispute in some Iraqi's house? Are you going to send a corporal from Arkansas to solve the problem? Or would you rather have an Iraqi policeman go in there who knows what's going on, speaks the language, and solve it? Well, they got rid of the police. So you had chaos. We created the groundswell for chaos. It was we dealt with CENTCOM, and we told CENTCOM, look, we're in touch with a variety of military units, and they're willing to surrender. As long as they see American troops, they feel they're not going to be left behind hanging, you know, holding the bag, but they see US troops, they'll surrender. The problem was, the Secretary of Defense had limited the number of troops the U.S. can send in. The full war plan called for 500,000. That got cut down to 250. They made a cut down to 140,000. And so when we briefed CENTCOM on this, they said, well, we can't take prisoners. We're, because of the restrictions and the number of people, we're allowed one military police brigade. And their job is going to keep the highway between Kuwait and Baghdad open. That's it. That's all we got for. We can't take hundreds of thousands of prisoners. So they sent them home. They sent leaflets throughout the thing and said, go home. And they did. And they took their weapons with them and they went home.
And so, this chaos ultimately results in the rise of ISIS.
Yes. It is in a vacuum. There's a lot of people that are ready to fill it, and the wrong people fill the vacuum. And it was a long time, a painfully long time, before elements of the administration accepted the fact that we had an insurgency. For months, the analysts tried to brief on a growing insurgency, and they were constantly smacked down by the Pentagon saying, we don't have an insurgency, we don't have an insurgency. And eventually, during one briefing, the Secretary of Defense said, you know, what's your definition of an insurgency? And I will grant this to the analyst. The analyst said, we're using the Pentagon definition. And at that point, they couldn't deny it. They said, okay, we got an insurgency. But they weren't dealing with it. They allowed it to fester and grow until it was a full-blown shitstorm.
So the $64 million question, as you look back on this experience and what happened as a result, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I hate that question.
Have to ask.
No, I know you do. It's an extremely difficult question. My son fought in Iraq. A lot of agency officers' sons and daughters fought in Iraq. Some lost sons and daughters. I think to myself, for a moment, there was an opportunity. It didn't have to be what it became. It's Saddam and his sons were horrible human beings. And I have no problems with them being killed. They're just trash. They're horrible. I do have a problem with what came after that. And I have a problem with the thousands of Americans who died, the tens of thousands of Iraqis who died, and the fact that we made it worse. We didn't prove anybody's life. We made it worse. To be honest, there's not a day I do not think about those Americans. We as a government fucked up big time.
Today, there seems to be a consensus about forever wars, and we're sort of haunted in some ways by the forever wars after 9/11, Afghanistan, and of course, Iraq. Have we learned our lessons? Have we learned the lessons from that too well so that maybe we are not as robust as we could possibly be, or have we not learned them well enough?
We have not learned. I have no doubt that we have not learned. You could see it in the discussions about Mexico and the cartels. It's a thing that I think for case officers is extremely dangerous. And it is also extremely dangerous for governments and administrations. And that's wishful thinking. This idea, if we do A, B is going to happen and everything will be fixed and we move on. And you're like, no. The other side has a say in this. And shit's going to change, and it's not going to be what you get. And because you're planning, because you want it to be to go from here to here, like when, you know, they get up and say, well, this is not an invasion, and Mexico should accept that. No, that's not what's going to happen. It is an invasion. Mexico won't accept it. There's going to be things that are going to happen that you do not know and don't predict. And they don't have a game plan for the day after. They don't have a game plan for what if this happens. They don't take that into account. No, this is not going to happen because I don't want it to happen. And I say it's not going to happen. And that's the problem with Iraq. They said, this is what's going to happen in Iraq. And people are like, not necessarily. Nope, it's going to happen. And they don't plan for anything outside of that. I don't think we've learned. I think we are going to continue. Let me say it in a more polite fashion. We're going to keep sticking our finger into the trap, and it's going to get snapped off because we don't think long term.
Well, on that sobering thought, Louise, I want to thank you for an absolutely fascinating discussion that I hope lots of people listen to, because there is much wisdom in what you have to say. So thanks a lot for joining us on Spy Talk.
First time somebody said I was wise. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Marley Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.